This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Later this hour, Bethany Chaffin's got a great new book to share. It's by Vice President of Educational Programming for Major League Baseball, Sharon Robinson, daughter of the man who broke the color barrier in baseball back in 1947, Hall of Famer Jackie Robinson, and Eddie Garcia and Amplifier Zine founder and editor-in-chief Jen Hasty showcase the underdogs of North Carolina music, film, and art. But first, did you know that back in the mid-80s, there were roughly 500,000 people serving time in our nation's jails and prisons? Today, that number is close to 2 million. Each year, thousands of former inmates return home after serving their time. Release, From Stigma to Acceptance, is a fascinating student-curated exhibition going on at the Sawtooth School for Visual Art in Winston-Salem, chronicling that often traumatic period of transition. Release features the words and visual art of former offenders who have graduated from Project Reentry. Through documented interviews with Wake Forest University Public History Course students, they've shared the personal challenges they face reentering society, adjusting to life outside, finding employment, trusting their support systems outside of prison, and learning to believe in themselves once again. Wake Forest University Assistant Professor of History Lisa Blee spoke with me about what has become a transformative experience for both the students and Project Reentry participants. And I can't wait for my life to
start again. So Project Reentry Program coordinators assured me that they would find volunteers from their graduates who would be willing to talk to students about their art and sit down for, you know, an hour-long interview with a couple of students to just kind of give them their stories. So I was recruiting students. Project Reentry, they started calling their graduates who they knew had some artistic talent, who had presented them with a short story or a poem at the graduation, or who had kept in touch and after their release had continued to do art, and asked them if they were willing to come in for an interview. And I believe almost everyone they asked was willing to do so. So there were a handful of artists that were generous enough to sit down for interviews with students and then give us their artwork to curate.
We'll kind of flesh out that interaction then between the students and the Project Reentry graduates.
Well, I think the first step, students were a bit nervous about the interviews. They were very excited about the prospect, right? But also nervous because many of them had not interviewed anyone before. So actually the first step that Project Reentry Program coordinators and I came up with was actually the students should go to Forsyth Correctional Center and go to a Project Reentry class and just kind of get to know what happens in those classes and start to see the program participants as just regular people, right? So the students went in for these prison visits, they participated in the classes along with the prisoners, and coming out of that, many of them were shocked by the realization that these are regular people. There was very little that separated them from the students themselves. So they were put at ease by that experience. So then sitting down for these interviews, the students brought a lot of curiosity, and you know, we had set questions that they asked, but almost all of them went off script and just had really great conversations with the program graduates and the artists.
And most of the program graduates and artists were incarcerated for drug offenses?
Well, we didn't ask what they were incarcerated for. I told them not to ask, but if one of their interviewers just kind of self-disclosed and wanted to talk about it, then they did. And almost all of them self-disclosed what they were in for. So yeah, it was drug offenses, and other matters. I don't think anyone was in for a violent crime. That was an interesting thing that we talked about in class, though, too, what that curiosity means about us. You know, like, are we going to approach these artists' work with a different mindset if we know what they're in for, right? If it's violence versus a drug offense, right? Are we going to be less open to their art and their stories? It was an interesting issue to think through.
What did you hear from the graduates in terms of those interactions? What was the experience like from their perspective, talking with Wake Forest University students in this context?
So I only listened to the audio of the interviews. The students really maintained the relationships with the interviewees. I didn't speak to them, but the students did share with me some emails that the interviewees wrote to them, you know, after the interviews, thanking them for listening. That was pretty much it. They were so grateful that these students kind of cared enough to listen to what they had to say. It was very simple, but it was, I think, meaningful for them.
Now the student curators, I should say, have gathered this information, formalized it in some way for this presentation at Sawtooth. What are they hoping to achieve through this project?
Well, when the students shared their interviews with one another, they started to see kind of surprising connections across the interviews. So, you know, first we just had discussions about what surprised them in the interviews, what they didn't expect to hear, what the major theme was. So they came out with two main themes. One was the hardships and challenges that the interviewees described when they were first released. And the second theme was, and this was the kind of larger and more prominent theme, which was the support systems that they relied on through their imprisonment and then afterward at reentry. So their family, Project Reentry, and other friends who were trying to find jobs or to also beat addiction, and how important that social support was for helping them change their lives and build confidence in their own abilities. So those were the two themes that we worked with. And then students selected quotes that they thought best kind of embodied those two themes. And when the artists gave us their artwork, the students kind of, you know, asked the artists to interpret the drawings and the stories to give some context for those things. And then based on the artists' interpretations of their work, the students organized those art pieces into the themes as a way of illustrating the kind of complexity of those two themes.
Tell me about some of the challenges that people face after spending years incarcerated, getting back out into society, and how they came out through this work, through this project.
One of the more surprising elements that students found in these interviews was that, well, we expected that former offenders would primarily have a difficult time finding employment, right? The check-the-box problem, right, where you have to acknowledge your rap sheet. I mean, that was true. That did come out in the interviews. But another thing that came out that was really surprising was that these men had to adjust first to just living outside of the regimented schedule of prison life. They had to readjust to family relationships, to connecting with people, to trusting people. You know, they may have been conditioned to be watching their back and to always be on edge and to always be told where to go and what to do. And just kind of coming back into the free world, right, and figuring out how to be okay in those circumstances, I think that was one of those surprising things that, you know, we all learned by talking to former offenders about their reentry process. It was not so much the economic challenges of finding a job that hit us as significant. It was the way one has to remake yourself, right, and kind of recreate your identity after being in prison, which is just so different. So it gave us all a great deal of respect for the enormity of the task, right, and that reentry is not for the faint of heart, right, and that we take so many things for granted, but trying to really rebuild your world when you may not have family that supports you or your friends can't be your friends anymore, right? Like, it's a daunting prospect.
When you break it down for me that way, it seems like there's a logical connection then between release and then the high incidence of recidivism.
One of the things I learned from Project Reentry Program coordinators was that former offenders are less likely to offend against a community in which they feel welcomed and supported, right? It's a sense of alienation that might account for some of the recidivism rates. And this is a really successful program. You know, their recidivism rates for their program graduates are far below national levels. I think the program is successful because it works not just at getting people jobs or helping people to navigate employment opportunities, but also how to accept, confront the stigma that is placed on former offenders and how to not let that get them down, you know, how to not see closed doors, but rather there are opportunities if you believe in yourself, kind of acknowledging that there's this stigma, but it doesn't have to be a limiting factor, I think is what helps former offenders to get through this really difficult process.
To get into specifics, I mean, getting into the stories of Project Reentry grads, Ron Hartzler, a 64-year-old, is going to be featured, a poem he wrote for his daughter and a short story about his 42-year addiction to drugs. And he credits Project Reentry for freeing him from addiction. What are some specific ways that the project does this?
Ron credits Michael Thomas at Project Reentry for helping him to save his life, for giving him hope and confidence in himself. And Ron has seen the successes that come from those things, right? There's no more time to waste. This is his only life. And Michael Thomas has really helped him to embrace it and to see that he's not only up to the task, but he's worth it to give himself the life that he wants.
Is Michael Thomas a director at Project Reentry?
Michael Thomas is a program coordinator at Project Reentry. And one of the great things about Project Reentry, too, is that many of the program coordinators are also former offenders. They can connect to, you know, their clients in a really personal way, and they understand what they're going through.
Yeah.
So they can offer that, yeah, that level of understanding. Ron's been employed for years now. I think Ron's been out for about 5 years, and he's having a great deal of success in this job, and he's clean. And yeah, he thinks of Michael Thomas and the support system of Project Reentry as the factor that made all the difference in saving his life from the cycle of incarceration and addiction that he was trapped in.
Got a family that cares in the world out there.
I love Sawtooth, and the venue is great. I walk in the door there, what am I going to see?
Most exhibits are designed for the space in which they'll go up, and this is no exception. We have this really great space, which is actually a hallway. It lends itself well to the idea of a journey, right? So the first part of the exhibit, we have the title and the main idea, which is really to ask the viewers to think about their own expectations of what a former offender looks like. And once they have formed that idea, then the next panel is the students' own reactions as they started to think about their preconceived notions. The next steps bring you to images of individuals, right? People who have been incarcerated and have graduated from Project Reentry, people that you can connect to, right? They're smiling faces, and they are just people. And then we have the historical context for understanding what reentry is, right? Which is really Project Reentry is a rehabilitation program. And this belief in rehabilitation, really the goodness of people, right? Belief in the goodness of people to change, that has been a part of our incarceration system and our policies for a couple of hundred years. So we're kind of trying to place incarceration, mass incarceration, and rehabilitation programs into greater context. And then we go into the themes, right? So you kind of travel through this, these different levels of connection, right? With your own expectations, with other human beings in this community, and then with the kind of the larger context in which these stories take place. And then we have two themes that include artwork and excerpts from the interviews. The first theme is hardships and challenges of coming out of prison. And the second theme was support systems like family, the project reentry programs, and other friends who are trying to find jobs and beat addiction.
Wake Forest University Assistant Professor of History, Lisa Blee. We've been sampling from an original song titled These Four Walls. It was composed and performed in the Forsyth Correctional Center in Winston-Salem by Project Reentry graduates Stephen McBride and Eric Parnell. Release, From Stigma to Acceptance, the student-curated exhibition at the Sawtooth School for Visual Art in Winston-Salem, will remain on display through February 28th. You'll find links to more information at WFDD.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and Eddie Garcia's got a close-up look at the underground arts scene in North Carolina. And Bethany Chafin chats it up with author and vice president of educational programming for Major League Baseball, Sharon Robinson. Sharon's new picture book, Testing the Ice, illustrated by Kadir Nelson, pays homage to her dad, the late great Hall of Famer, Jackie Robinson. And Bethany Chafin shares her conversation with the author just about 5 minutes from now. Well, back in the 1830s, George Catlin was among the first painters to chronicle the Indian chiefs of the American West and the Great Plains buffalo upon which they and their tribes depended. Although Catlin was underappreciated and plagued with debt throughout his adult life, he was a visionary whose 500-plus paintings did much to shape our own perceptions of 19th-century Native American culture. The Rinalda House Museum of American Art exhibition is titled George Catlin's American Buffalo. Curatorial and Education Division Director Elizabeth Chu.
In a way, he painted portraits of buffalo. One of the kind of signature images in the exhibition is of a very large, ferocious-looking buffalo bull, but it's looking right at you. I mean, you can sort of make eye contact with it, but I don't think anybody else ever thought about painting a, you know, an animal that way.
The landscape, What am I saying that gives me an emotional, visceral attraction versus not?
Sure. Well, his paintings are actually all very small. Most of them are about, 19.5 by 28 inches, which when people see them in person, they're often very surprised by. Because on these canvases, he absolutely captures the vastness of the Great Plains. And I think it's because in most of them, the horizon line is kind of in the middle of the canvas. So you're seeing basically kind of half and half, land and sky. And so he's very good at suggesting, the way that your eye would have such a long view into the horizon.
Okay.
So he manages to capture a sense of great expanse in a very small surface area.
Well, another thing he managed to capture from so many different vantage points, the role of the buffalo in that culture. And what do we learn from that?
Sure. Basically, these were nomadic peoples whose, life was hunting buffalo. And they used parts of the buffalo for every part of their existence, from food, obviously, clothing, shelter in terms of teepees. They could make boats for traveling on the river. There were many aspects of their religious and ceremonial lives that involved either wearing part of a buffalo headdress, or dancing in a way like buffalo. They used horses for chasing the buffalo. So basically, without the buffalo, their cultures were not possible. Catlin wasn't just painting exact replications of what his eyes see. A portrait of a person is always some kind of a collaboration or relationship between two people. So these are not just documents. Catlin's also communicating something about what he thinks about the individuals and their cultures, too. And I think that little relationship is why the portraits of human beings have such enormous impact. They're very profound and very dignified.
Well, share with our listeners one of your favorites.
Sure. I think probably my very favorite is a portrait of a Lakota chief named Black Rock. And he's standing. He's wearing the traditional eagle feather headdress that we associate so closely with Plains Indians. And he's wearing one of the most important symbols of a celebrated warrior, which is a buffalo robe, and the hide is painted with pictographs that tell stories about this individual's exploits in battle. He's also wearing a headpiece that contains buffalo horns, so another, yet another way that the buffalo were used. He's wearing leggings and moccasins that are decorated with quill work, which is another really amazing Northern Plains art, which is done by women, and they use porcupine quills that they dye with, natural dyes, and then they sew and weave them to create decorative embellishments for clothing and all kinds of other objects as well. It's an amazing art form. It's still alive and well on the Great Plains today.
Rinalda House, Curatorial and Education Division Director Elizabeth Chu. George Catlin's American Buffalo opens Friday, February 13th. Several related programs and events are planned through May, including Elizabeth's gallery talk on Thursday, February 19th at noon. And on March 5th, it's an after-hours exploration of objects from the Wake Forest University Museum of Anthropology, including beadwork and bow and arrow making workshops with Sawtooth School instructor Dane Snodgrass. On April 11th, from 11 to 3, it'll be Community Day Powwow Cultural Festival on the Rinalda Lawn, presented by the Guilford Native American Association. Representatives from North Carolina tribes will share traditional art, storytelling, dance, and drumming. And on April 16th, the program titled Lakota Voices, with young Native American Indian members of the South Dakota tribe sharing oral histories of their ancestors and chronicling their struggles to retain their language and culture during a dark chapter in our nation's history. You'll find links to the complete calendar of events on our website, WFDD.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. We'll be back in just a moment with Eddie Garcia, Bethany Chafin, and lots of great arts happenings next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin. Later this hour, Eddie Garcia talks with Amplifier Zine editor-in-chief and founder Jen Hasty. But first, my conversation with Sharon Robinson. Sharon Robinson is a writer, educator, and former nurse midwife. She's also the daughter of baseball legend Jackie Robinson. After playing with the Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro Leagues, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball in 1947 when he joined the Montreal Royals, the farm team for the Brooklyn Dodgers. The career that followed was impressive. 1,518 hits, 137 home runs, 734 runs batted in, and 197 stolen bases. He was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1962. His daughter Sharon Robinson currently serves as the Vice President of Educational Programming for Major League Baseball. She's written works of nonfiction and fiction, and several of her books are about her father, including Jackie's Nine, Jackie Robinson's Values to Live By, Stealing Home, Promises to Keep, and her latest, Testing the Ice. Bookmarks, in conjunction with Twin City Stage, will bring Sharon to Winston-Salem on Saturday, February 28th. Her visit coincides with the Children's Theater's performance of Play to Win, a musical which highlights the relationship between Brooklyn Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson. Sharon will attend the Saturday performance at 11 a.m., and she will be signing books after the show. I spoke to Sharon Robinson by phone. Could you tell me about the program Breaking Barriers?
Yeah, it's sort of weird because I started off as a nurse midwife and have always loved, had a very deep love for children. I thought when I was a little girl that I would be a nurse, but I also thought I'd have an orphanage. So I was always waiting as a child for somebody to drop a baby off at our home in Stamford, Connecticut. And I figured, you know, we had plenty of space. You know, we'd be a perfect family for them to drop off an unwanted baby. So that was how I thought I was, you know, going to end up. So after about 25 years in nursing and midwifery, I had the opportunity to do something different, sort of combine my love for children with a desire for them to help them understand that life was filled with obstacles and we had to be strong and have a way to manage the obstacles in our lives. So I came to baseball at a time when baseball was celebrating its 50th anniversary, and they had themed that year Breaking Barriers. So I essentially, once they brought me aboard, I essentially created a program with Breaking Barriers as the theme and used a values-based program to help kids develop strategies to overcome obstacles in their lives. And ended up partnering with Scholastic, and it's just been an incredible partnership. We're in our 19th year, and it's a curriculum that goes into the school. It started off as a box kit that went out, and the kids all got colored brochures. It was very, very fancy and very nice, but we couldn't reach as many children. So we started off only in our Major League Baseball market. Then when we had a demand outside of our baseball market, we moved into a model that was national, and we do that now both in a posted teacher guide format that's easier to mail out and more cost-effective, and also online. The program culminates in the children writing an essay about a barrier or obstacle they've had to overcome in their lives, and they have to describe it and talk about the strategies they've used to get beyond it or to deal with it, and bring in one of my father's the values that I've identified as values that help my father be successful on and off the field. They bring that into their strategies. And then we select national winners, and I go out on a spring tour with some staff from baseball, and we connect with the local teams and bring baseball into the school, and also recognize the kids that have won the essay contest, and then bring them over to ballpark where they're recognized. And then our grand prize winners are honored at the pregame, at the World Series, and at the All-Star game.
That sounds like a great program. And you said that it's a values-based program that also the students draw on the values that your father embodied and taught. And I wonder if you could elaborate on what some of those values were.
Yes, I can. You know, determination, persistence, courage, integrity, teamwork, citizenship, commitment, excellence. So they're all, you know, really survival values. And we weren't about making judgments. It's really about how do you survive and how do you grow as a person. Mm-hmm. And how do you learn to commit yourself into your community and the larger world and want to make a difference in the world?
So in the book Testing the Ice, there's this wonderful scene where you, your siblings, and some of your friends are gathered around and you're talking to your dad. And you have this phrase that says, and they asked him questions in ways we never thought to ask. And I'm wondering what sorts of questions they asked, and in your work now, what sorts of questions you're getting that maybe help you to continue to see your dad in different lights.
They wanted to understand how he broke the color barrier, and it was something, we just knew he did it as his children, and we knew there was a trophy room in our house, and people told us all kinds of stories, but we didn't ask him, what was that like? It was almost like we were afraid to hear those stories because we knew there was pain in them. And it was intimacy I wasn't ready for until I was actually in college. They wanted to understand what it was like to be not allowed to do something just because of the color of your skin. Or, how did you handle that anger? What did you do with it? Were you angry at home? And that's really what the kids want to know today. Because, it's the same as being bullied. And so kids are coming up to me quietly afterwards and saying, I'm going through the same thing, or I'm going through something similar. But in the larger group, they'll say, well, how did he express his anger? What is the appropriate way? How do you handle going into a situation where you're different than all the other kids? And they want to know kids today, because the kids that came to our house saw him at home and understood him as a father. But the kids today, they want to understand, well, what was he like as a father? Was he really in your life? Was he a part of your life? And, what did you do together? And how did you feel about having a famous father?
Now, I wonder if for our listeners, you could give us a little bit of a timeline as far as how old you were when your dad was playing and when he retired and also when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame and things like that. Could you give us a brief timeline of that?
Certainly. My father broke into the majors in 1947, although he played in 1946 for Montreal in the Farm League, Dodgers Farm League. So I was born in 1950. And I was actually, I just turned 7 when my father retired from Major League Baseball because he retired after the 1956 season, and it wasn't official until January of 1957. The Dodgers actually left for California after the 1957 season, so there was all kinds of changes going on in Brooklyn, and Ebbets Field had gotten very old, and they ended up joining the westward expansion of baseball and being one of two teams that moved to California. And then when my dad was, then 5 years after you retire, you're eligible to be voted into the Hall of Fame. My father was voted in the first time, so I was actually 12 when he was elected into the Hall of Fame. So that I have very sort of clear memories of that day and that experience. Whereas his baseball years, I was really too young to remember them. I remember most going to spring training, but that was only because we would go to Florida in the middle of the winter from Connecticut. So it was the change of climate and the ability to go swimming in the middle of winter made going to Florida very exciting as opposed to us really going to watch my father train.
I know you said you're a little too young to remember, some specific things from his baseball days, but you do describe a favorite photograph you had of him as a kid. And I wonder if you could describe that photograph and if it's still your favorite picture of him.
When I was growing up, we had this trophy room, like I said, in the lower level of our house. But when we came up the staircase from the garage, there was the photo of my father from the ceiling home. And it was the one where he's coming in with his hand is fisted and the dirt is all up around him and he has this sort of, very determined look on his face. So what I loved about this photo is it was very inspirational. It was reminding me that, you have to set goals and be determined. And they were very important in our house. My mother was very goal-oriented, and so was my father. And so this photograph was sort of, it was my dad, but it was also a very strong family value. Now today, I have a know, different favorite photos. I have a favorite one of him. It was actually just a tiny snapshot. It was taken of my father holding me in his arms when we were down in Florida at spring training. And actually in Jackie's Nine, I believe, but it's one of my favorite photos of my father and I. I love this other one of him that was one of the last photos we have, and of him being very pensive. And, you know, so you kind of have the feeling it's a later in life photo, and it turned out to be one of the last ones. And then I have a favorite one of my father and mother, and their heads are together, and it's at a jazz concert in our house in Stamford, Connecticut. This particular jazz concert, unlike the other ones we had where we were raising money for the Civil Rights Movement, this particular one was to raise money for DATOP, which was a program that my brother Jackie was a resident of for a number of years and also worked there after he was no longer a resident. It's a very loving photo of the two of them, and it's like a very private photo, and yet it's quite public. Mm-hmm. I just love that one.
Well, thank you for sharing those. So you're writing for an audience of younger readers sometimes, and you really distill the complicated issues down into something that's very easy to grasp, accessible. And right. I wonder if it's ever hard because you think, there's no way that I can capture all of the nuance, all of the tension and the sadness even of this time period or the things that your father was experiencing and express it in a lighter way sometimes, which you need to do in children's literature.
Right.
Is that a tension that you ever come across?
Certainly. I mean, it is a very conscious effort on your part. I think that's where my teaching background comes in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether I'm teaching a woman how to deliver a baby, you know, you have to bring it right down to the essence, you know, and you have to do it in a way that sometimes you're actually teaching while they're delivering. Let's take, you know, if you have a difficult birth. And so I think that that's when it started with me. And so I enjoy that part. I enjoy trying to figure out how to make something that's really complex understandable for kids. And it's not always easy. Well, I actually love the picture book because you do get the combination of the art and the words to bring a story to life. And even a difficult story about a time period where a child has no reference, no frame of reference. You know, by combining the art and the words, you can bring it to life. And I just love how Kadir brings both the tension on the baseball diamond to life, as well as the tension as my father's stepping out deeper onto the ice, to the deepest part, and we have to be, and children are all lined up, fearful that he would fall in, and knowing that my father couldn't swim. So it's just, he just does this beautiful picture where my father's out there by himself, and you feel that aloneness and that commitment from this man that he's willing to do this in spite of the fact that he can't swim.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same kind of commitment that we're describing when we're talking about him breaking the color barrier. I'm actually just finished a book that turned out to be, I just absolutely love this book. When I was starting, I was like, how am I going to get into this voice? Because it's the voice of an 8-year-old Jewish boy from 1948 in Brooklyn.
Okay.
So you have the nuance of Brooklyn, the Brooklyn Dodgers, all told through this boy's voice. Now this boy is still my dear friend. Mm. So I, you know, had many conversations with him and talking about what his childhood was like. So actually when I started going into character and telling it in first person, I found it quite fun to do, you know, to be someone completely different than who I am and to imagine what it was like. I mean, it just turned out to be just this great experience. And part of what's so great and wonderful about writing about doing historical writing, you know, even though it's historical fiction, you have to bring the times into it. And so I'm going through it, and I get to the point, I go, oh, my goodness, Jewish boy, and this is 1948. This is when the Arab-Israeli war is, hot. And I've got to bring that in. And, it's just fascinating how you're able to weave that into the story. And so anyway, it was just one of my most challenging and yet most fun projects.
It sounds like it. And what's the name of that project? Who's the character?
Well, it's the hero, Two Doors Down, an unlikely friendship between a Brooklyn boy and a baseball legend. Actually, another true story that I had told in picture book format, a piece of it. I had told a piece of when my parents moved into this predominantly Jewish neighborhood in 1948, and it's my dad's second year with the Dodgers, and that Christmas he gives this Steve, the neighborhood boy who he's become friendly with, he gives him a Christmas tree, not understanding that he's Jewish and therefore they don't celebrate Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very cute, lovely as a picture book, and I was able to bring in some of this background in the picture book, but Scholastic asked me to do it as a middle grade novel, and oh my goodness, it's such a rich story when you are able to do it in a fuller format.
Right. One of the things I was really interested to find out in reading some of your works was the cultural climate that was being created by sports writers at the time when your father joined the Dodgers. And, some of those writers, you mentioned them, Frank A. Young, Sam Lacy, Shirley Povich.
Right.
Tell me what they were doing and how that sort of set the scene for what your father then did.
Well, because Major League Baseball was the American sport at the time, the sports writers put the focus on desegregation of sports on Major League Baseball. So that became their focus. So they wrote articles after articles. This is long before Branch Rickey approached my father. They were the impetus for change within baseball. And then certainly when at the end of the war, World War II, there were other forces that came in, including ministers, and but it really started with these sports writers. Baseball it represents America, and therefore you're representing segregation by having baseball be segregated. So it was their writings that got the attention of a Branch Rickey, and certainly the commissioner. The shift in commissioner and Happy Chandler taking over, again, allowed for that climate to open up to the possibility, but it was the sports writers that really started it all. And I was reading in preparation for this visit to Canada, I was rereading my father's first autobiography. He wrote it just after his first year in the majors, and he starts right off with, it wouldn't have happened without the pressure from the sports writers. And they don't get, enough of the credit. The credit tends to go towards Branch Rickey, but it really, that's why Branch Rickey sent Sam Lacy on tour with my father, because he understood the significance of him helping to break down this color barrier, but also continue to tell the story so that they would be successful and that people would know of their success so that it could spread throughout the rest of the Major League Baseball teams, and also, the overall hope is that it will then spread into other aspects of American life.
Writer and educator Sharon Robinson. Her latest book is a picture book called Testing the Ice, illustrated by Kadir Nelson. You can meet Sharon at Twin City Stage on Saturday, February 28th, thanks to Bookmarks and Twin City Stage, where the Children's Theater will be performing Play to Win, a musical based on the relationship between Jackie Robinson and Brooklyn Dodgers general manager Branch Rickey. The show is at 11 a.m. on Saturday, and Sharon will be signing books in the lobby afterwards. For more information on Sharon, Bookmarks, Twin City Stage, and more, visit our website at wfdd.org, and once you're there, click on Try At Arts Weekend. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend. Stick around for this week's Triad To Do, but first, after the break, Eddie Garcia talks to Amplifier Zine's editor-in-chief and founder, Jen Hasty.
Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Eddie Garcia. In about 5 minutes, the Triad Arts Weekend team will gather around the mic to fill your weekend arts to-do list. But first, let's open up a copy of Amplifier Zine. In the world of punk and underground music, the zine has been its hardscrabble literary companion for years. A zine is usually photocopied, stapled, and generally of lesser physical quality compared to a magazine. When Amplifier Zine was launched in Greensboro 2 years ago, it shared these qualities. Founder and editor-in-chief Jen Hasty launched her publication, with the help of lots of friends, as a way to bridge her passions for music and journalism. While the commitment to promoting the underdogs of music, film, and art have remained, the publication has physically evolved, adding a touch of gloss and a loss of a staple here and there.
The first issue was 24 pages. It was printed on computer paper, just hand-stapled it. The only difference with a usual zine is that every page was designed on software, so we had no photocopying whatsoever. The quality was kind of hit or miss. Now we're sitting around 100 pages, so we've grown a ton.
So then you started Amplifier in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you have the initial idea?
It was February 2013. I had graduated from UNCG in 2012, really wanted to utilize my degree. So I met up with a couple friends. They kind of steered me in the direction of realizing I had resources around me where I could get it printed, get it started, enough people who had interest in writing, taking pictures, helping out with design. Within a week of talking to those people, had a meeting, decided on everything, recruited a bunch of my friends, and then within 3 months, we released our first issue. We mainly feature bands who are releasing new albums, have news, and are in need of promotion. The genre always varies. We've had hip-hop artists, we've had metal bands, country bands. My main perspective behind featuring bands is that they're not all inclusive to one aspect of North Carolina.
Are you and your contributing writers seeking out bands to cover, or are they coming to you?
Yeah, well, it's both. Okay. We have bands contact us all the time who want to be featured. When we have our planning meetings, all the writers will come in with their own ideas, and it is primarily music. So we'll separate it to where we have a certain amount of bands, a certain amount of businesses, venues, artists. We've always kind of steered toward music, which I think is why we have pretty much been considered a music publication.
You said primarily music, so what else are you covering?
We cover artists.
As in visual artists?
Yes. Okay. So we do that. We do businesses, venues. We cover writers sometimes, local events, organizations.
And are you expanding your reach outside of the Greensboro music scene?
Yeah. We actually did that a couple months ago. We've established people in Boone, Wilmington, Raleigh, and Charlotte. Our last issue, which was released in December, that was our first issue as a North Carolina publication. So hopefully in the future, once we expand our reach across North Carolina, we'll be able to expand a little bit more.
And are you selling it through the internet, or is it a mail order thing, or is it in shops? Or
yeah.
How would someone get their hands on one?
It's kind of both. We have an online store where they're available. And then in Greensboro, we have them available at Hippo Records, CFBG, and New York Pizza right now.
The idea was always to have Amplifier in print. I mean, there is an online component, but the idea was to make a zine, something physical that you know, hold in your hand. You know, in 2015, that's kind of considered to be a little bit risky.
Right.
So why did you have to do this?
It is risky, especially considering that our newer issues are going to be way more expensive. But I love magazines. That's what I want to do pretty much for the rest of my life. I don't really see them dying off. I think of them more as collector's items like vinyl. And honestly, most of the people who read Amplifier, that's how they view it. So I don't think it's something that's going to die in my perspective, but it is very risky. But it's something that I think is necessary.
Do you feel that Amplifier is becoming a tastemaker of sorts, or do you feel more like you're responding to what's going on around you?
I would agree with the tastemaker thing. A lot of people find out about things that they've never even heard of through us, whether it's our actual print copies or if it's our website, our Facebook page, or anything. I find that that's very interesting, that Greensboro's a pretty small city. You're going to find something from someone, but I think that we've done a pretty good job at putting into words why you should care about something. And I think that that's been pretty beneficial to the community and at least our readers.
Jen Hasty. She's the founder and editor-in-chief of Amplifier Zine. The next issue comes out in March, but in the meantime, you can visit their website to read articles and check out their live music videos. The next Amplifier music event is February 21st at Black Cat Burrito in Boone. The music you've been hearing is by Greensboro's Black Squares White Islands. You'll find links to more music at Amplifier's website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
Well, as always, lots going on, nay, too much going on in the Triad to keep up with. So it's time for our Triad to do, and we're going to do it differently today because I have no idea what Eddie's picked or what Bethany's picked. And you don't know what I picked, did you?
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. It's a mystery for our listeners, too, and it's great fun. Well, this is for all of the Celtic music fans out there. I know there are lots of them. You know, the Fiona Ritchie's old show?
Thistle and Shamrock.
Thistle and Shamrock. She's going to be in town coming up this weekend along with Doug Orr. She and Doug have partnered up and written a book, Wayfaring Strangers, the musical voyage from Scotland and Ulster to Appalachia with Fiona Ritchie and Douglas Orr. There's going to be a book signing and discussion. For those of you not in the know, I mean, this region is rich with that kind of music because I guess throughout the 18th and 19th century, a big stream of Scots migrated to via Ulster to Appalachia, set up there. And in this book, Fiona Ritchie and Doug guide readers through that voyage and what it has meant to us kind of musically speaking in this region. Kind of got me going. Paul Brown was in town last weekend with his Across the Blue Ridge over at Seekin. Got me thinking of traditional Appalachian music. And you hear these Scotch-Irish sounds in so much of the music. It's a rich tradition. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Fiona and Doug, huge scholars. If you want to learn anything about it, pick up the book. It's Friday the 13th from 3 to 4:30 over at Greensboro College, the Campbell Lyceum, Proctor Hall, West 109. But if you miss them, pick up the book, because it comes along with a CD featuring 20 songs by musicians that were influenced by this music, including Dolly Parton, who wrote the foreword for the book, Pete Seeger, David Holt's in there, Doc Watson, so many others.
Wow.
So that's coming up. That's the little Celtic music nod. So if you love your Celtic, go get them.
Well, speaking of love, a lot of people are gearing up for Valentine's Day this weekend. And if you're listening before Valentine's Day, here's an option on Friday evening at 7 on February 13th. Scuppernong Books in Greensboro is holding their first non-erotic reading. So maybe a fun Valentine's Day alternative. They're trying to find the least sexy romantic literature that they can find across all genres. And they're going to be sharing that with those who attend.
Now, to me, non-erotic would be like an instruction manual.
Right. Well, and that might be the case. I don't know. Okay. I think it's open to interpretation. Maybe you should go with an instruction manual.
Or a phone book.
Yep. Basically, if you go, you'll be hearing some wonderfully cringe-worthy love scenes that they have curated for you. Oh. So that's a nice Valentine's Day alternative. And that begins at 7 p.m. again at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro.
I can tell you from my used bookstore days, there is no shortage of non-erotic erotica out there. So
Maybe unintentionally non-erotic erotica. But
yeah, that could be an interesting event. Well, what I have for this weekend is a Valentine's Day EP release party with the band Daddy Issues. And Daddy Issues are a band that I believe started off about a year ago in Greensboro, and in a pretty short amount of time, they've blown up on the local and regional scene, even getting some attention overseas from the magazine Mojo, which is the British equivalent of Rolling Stone. Oh, yeah. Over here, they're kind of a garagey surf pop band with like really infectious melodies and a real good sense of swagger, and they're a fun band to see live. So this is their EP release party. Their EP is being released on Negative Fun Records, and it'll be available digitally and also on cassette. Because apparently that's what the kids are doing again these days.
I love cassettes.
As if vinyl wasn't enough.
No, I love my
cassette. Now they're putting them out on cassette.
All right.
It's cheap and it's kind of fun. It's a whole thing with having a physical product in your hand, right? I think that people are into now if you're going to spend money on something with everything being free. So along with Daddy Issues, the band Towers, who we've had on Triad Arts, is also playing. They're a very distinctly different band. Towers is doing a really clean, super R&B, indie pop kind of thing, but both dynamic performers. And along with each of them, not to discount the other bands. We also have Free Clinic from Wilmington and Totally Slow from Greensboro, which there's a fellow dad rocker in that band named Scott Hicks. He's an old friend of mine from Greensboro.
You'll have a club?
Well, yeah, we have a club. Yeah.
Is it called Daddy Issues?
Perhaps. Anyway, so that's going on Saturday night at the Local Honey Salon in Greensboro. So rock out and take your Valentine's out if you guys like to listen to crazy music.
Well, that's all for today's show. Our technical producer is Eddie Garcia, and our associate producer is Bethany Chafin. You'll find links to all of our guests, as well as our Triad to-do lists, on our website, wfdd.org, and click on Triad Arts Weekend. If you'd like to send us suggestions for future shows, email us at triadarts@wfu.edu. You can follow us on Twitter at @TriadArtsSpeak, and in the meantime, we hope you'll tune in next week. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.